good horse, I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of
home. It is a sign of immaturity, fear, and hysteria that this elaborated system, with so much to offer, is unavailable for the vast majority of people.
And this we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight.
You're listening to episode 624 of Unwelcome Guests, the vast machine to perpetuate hopelessness. I'm Robin Upton, and that title is a quote from David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years, which we shall be reading a little from at the end of our second hour. Now, that hopelessness relies to quite a large extent on lack of knowledge of history and a lack of framework for understanding what is modern capitalist society. We're going to spend this show on the first part of a set of talks on Marxian class analysis by Richard Wolff, whom we've just heard, Professor Emeritus of Economics, and the apparatus which he sadly notes is lacking from most Americans is the framework of Marxian class analysis, which has been the focus of his life's work. So, without further ado, here is Richard Wolff. I think this recording is from 2010, introducing and then detailing Marxian class analysis.
Welcome, everyone. I should explain briefly that this is designed to be a course at once theoretical and practical. The idea is to bring everyone up to date on what Marxian class analysis is, how it has evolved, like everything else, and changed over time, as have other theories, as has Marxism itself. And then most of the classes are going to be in how to apply it, how to use this kind of class analysis. And I will be working very hard to demonstrate to you the very different understandings of major events in our time that you get if you use class analysis in the Marxian way, as compared to how other approaches and other kinds of analysis work, so that you can see very practically what the gains are from using a sophisticated Marxian analysis. So let me begin with a few introductions to set the tone for what I'm trying to do here. First, class, I would argue, the concept of class and class analysis is one of the most repressed discourses in our culture. It has a taboo attached to it. It's like discussing in the inappropriate group details of your sex life or details of your personal interactions with your folks or something like that. It is not done in large parts of our culture. No kind of sophisticated class analysis can be found in, say, the congressional record. Our elected representatives in neither house at the federal level, nor in any state house that I'm aware of, ever make use of the term. And as I'll show you a little bit later, on those few occasions when there is reference to class, it's a stereotypic caricature that is brought forward, not any kind of sophisticated argument. So part of the course in class analysis is, to use the categorical Freudian idea, a return of the repressed. It is bringing back into our language, into our frameworks of thought, a concept that has been at the forefront of thinking in the past, but has been repressed largely since the end of the Second World War for all kinds of historical and political reasons, and which is, by the way, coming back now. So in a sense, this course helps you to understand a way of thinking that you're going to be seeing and hearing more and more in the years ahead. The second thing I need to focus you on is that the concept of class, when you actually hear it, and we do hear it from time to time, means very different things to different people. So we have a very peculiar situation here with class analysis, in that the same word means radically different things to different people, and that there's no way around having to deal with that. And one of the things we're going to do today is go through with you some of the fundamentally different ways this concept is working today and has worked historically since it's been around a long time. And that has to be done so that you are not confused, misled, when you hear the term class, as you will more and more, because you think everybody who's using the term means the same thing when they don't. Okay, so let's begin. First, the simplest way to begin is to look at the word itself, class. What does it mean to talk about a class? What is it? Well, the word class comes from a verb, and the verb is to classify. So all that really class means is you're taking a group of something and breaking it down into subgroups. The subgroups are classes. So for example, among the things called living things, we break them, modern thought does, into two groups, plants and animals. We classify, that is, we subgroup all living things into the plants and the animals. There are people who use the term the class of animals as opposed to the class of plants. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing because you're classifying, you're breaking down. So the first meaning of the word class at the most general level is breaking down something, a population, a group, into subgroups. And each of them is a class. And of course you can do that lots of different ways. When it comes to human communities and you want to classify them, it means taking a population of people in a village, in a region, in the world, however you like, and breaking them down into subgroups. And human beings have been doing that for as long as we have a record of what human beings think and write and say to one another. So classification, class analysis, that is an analysis based on classifying, is as old as human thought. It is a commonplace, for example, in biology, that in order to understand how nature works, you have to break things down. One-celled organisms as opposed to multiple-celled organisms. Mammals as opposed to other kinds of animals. Those are all classifications. So when it comes to a human community, how have humans classified people? In all kinds of ways, and they're still doing that. For example, to be very modern, when the New York Times writes articles about the wars and struggles in Iraq, it breaks down the population of Iraq in order to tell a story about what's happening there into subgroups. Now, it doesn't call them classes, because there's a taboo on that language for reasons I'll come to. So, for example, it makes sense of Iraq by subdividing people as the following: Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, Turkmen. And so these are religious, ethnic, regional, these are classifications, all right. And you see what's being done. In order to tell a story about what's happening in the big group, Iraq, you break it down into subgroups, and you tell the story using that subgroup. If you are determined not to think in terms of class, then you do it, for example, the way the New York Times does, by making it as if it were the most natural and necessary thing in the world to analyze the totality of the population in Iraq by means of subgroups defined in terms of religion and region and ethnicity. So how to subdivide, how to classify a human community is always open to grab. Different people do it differently. Okay, so much for the general idea. Now let's go look at the way class has been used when that word itself is the word used to talk about the subgroups. Not the Sunnis and the Shiites, not the men and the women, another classification. Not the old and the young, another classification. But let's talk about how the word class has been used itself. When you've classified into groups, you call classes. Has that been going on for a long time in human history? Yes, very long. Is that particularly a Marxist idea? Not at all. Very important that before we begin to talk about the Marxist concept of class and how it's used, that you be aware that long before Marx was alive, class was used. As far back as ancient Greece and Rome, for example, abundant records showing that people broke the community down into different groups of people, which they called classes. How did they do that? Well, probably the oldest one that we have any record of is what we're going to call a property theory of class, a concept of class that defines class in terms of property. And here's how that works. And I urge you to pay attention because even though this is an old one, it's also very modern. It is used all the time, as you will see, today, yesterday, the day before yesterday. You're going to see it's on television, it's in books and articles you read, and so on. Anyway, it's very old. Here's the idea. You will understand a community of people by breaking down their membership, classifying them into groups called classes, and the principle of classification, how you divide people, is, and here we go now, according to the property they own or do not own. So we have the group of people who own a lot, the group of people who don't own anything. And if you like, you can have all kinds of gradations. The people who own a bit, but not a lot. People who own quite a bit, but not a ton. And people who are really loaded. There are varieties of words over the history of the human race that have been used to classify people into the class of owners and the class of the ownerless. The propertied, the propertyless. The haves and the have-nots. The rich and the poor. You get the picture? These are all different ways of organizing your society in terms of the classes who have property of some kind, wealth, and those who don't, and those who might be, very American now, in the middle class. They don't own a lot, but they're not propertyless either. They're in the middle. Very, very old. So, for example, if you go to ancient Greece, you can read, and there are wonderful books about this, some written by Marxists, for example, and others not, in which Greek society is understood as a complicated society. But if you want to understand how and why Greek society worked, I'm talking ancient Athens, Pericles, and all of that long ago, if you want to understand how it worked, how it changed over time, the argument goes, the way to understand that, the clue, the road into understanding, comes from asking these questions. Who had the property in ancient Greece? And who didn't? And how was the society divided? What was the relationship and the ratio between those who had and those who didn't? Such people, for example, would be very interested to discover that in ancient Greek society, where democracy was born, a minority of people had all the wealth. And the majority of people not only had no wealth, they were wealth. Because the majority of people in ancient Greece were slaves. The people themselves were the property of others. Not only did they not own anything, they didn't own themselves as individuals, as living bodies and minds. So you have a stark example of a person who believes in this kind of class analysis, that understanding comes from seeing how there are classes of owners and classes of propertyless, and then making sense of the society by the relations between them, the tensions between them, the envy between them, the admiration, all of the complicated relationships between the one class of rich and the other class of poor, and perhaps one or more middle classes. Okay? There are sociologists and political scientists and many radicals around the world who still use the same concept. I won't embarrass anyone in the room by asking whether any of you, when you think about class analysis, say of the United States today, also think almost automatically, well, yes, there's the rich and the poor, and the relationships between them, and the middle, and how it relates to the above and the below it. And that's what you do. There are huge amounts of work being produced right now in American journals, dozen of them, popular ones, academic ones, everything in between, in which an analysis is couched about the United States, often using the word class, often not, because it's a repressed discourse, but nonetheless, nonetheless, in that relationship between rich and poor, is thought to lie the key to unlocking what's going on in the United States. So this is a class analysis that divides people according to the property they own and makes sense of the world. Notice, to go back to my example of Iraq, if the New York Times' articles make sense of Iraq by the struggle between Sunnis and Shiites and Turkmen and Kurds, that's going to lead you to a very different understanding of what's going on there as compared to the kind of analysis you would get if you said, who owns the wealth in Iraq? Who doesn't? And what are the tensions and relationships there? That's a question very different from what's their ethnicity, what's your religion, and it turns out it might give you, and I guarantee you it does, a very different understanding of what's happening there, what the point and purpose of the American invasion was and is, where the future is going, and so forth. Okay, so it's very important to see these as different. Is this property concept, the notion of classes, the rich versus the poor? And by the way, there's a corollary to that. You can ask rich versus poor, not in terms of the wealth you own, but in terms of the income you're getting. So then the class of people who get a lot of money each year versus the people who get a little and the people who get none at all. So looking at the income breakdown, richer and poorer, is just another way of asking about classes, as if class was about how much money you get or how much money you own or wealth. Are there other concepts of class, using that word? Yes. And they're as old as the property one. Here's another one, very old, long before Marx or Marxism appeared on this earth. And I call this one the power theory of class, the power concept. Here we break down people in a community, we classify them into groups, subgroups, not in terms of what they own or earn, more or less, but in a completely different way. How much power do they wield? How much authority do they have? Are they order givers? Do they tell other people what to do? Or are they order receivers? They're told what to do. They're given orders. They have authority wielded over them. And you have all heard these. It's the class of the powerful versus the class of the powerless. It's the ruling class and the ruled. You're dividing people according to the power they do or do not have. And you make sense of a society in terms of the relationships between those who do have power and those who don't. So, for example, the American Revolution back in the 18th century was fought on a question of power. There was hatred for King George III in England because he, as the sovereign of Great Britain, of which the United States at that time was a colony, had all the power to make all the decisions, to give all the orders, and the colonists here in the United States had to take orders. And they made a revolt. We don't want to take orders. We don't want anyone to tell us to pay taxes, an order. We want to tell ourselves. No taxation without representation. Anyone heard of tea baggers? So this is an old idea. We want power. We want a different class structure, meaning, in these people's mind, a different distribution of power. And in our times, this theory is very powerful, only it has a slightly different name. Democracy. We want there to be a particular distribution of power such that everybody has the same power. One man, one vote. All these images. This is about an analysis that says you want to understand why society works the way it does, why it changes, why we have problems in the world, why we have. It's about power. It's about the people who don't have it, who want it. It's about the people who have it, who don't want to share it. and on and on. And that's another way of making sense. And for example, you would come to a very different understanding of Iraq today if what you saw was not a struggle between Shiites and Sunnis, or even for that matter, a struggle between rich and poor, but rather a struggle between those who have some power and those who are excluded. And make no mistake, you get different understanding depending on which of these classifications, which of these concepts of class you use. For example, Barack Obama is not in the ruling class of America if by that you mean property. He doesn't have much property, but he has a hell of a lot of power. So if you want to talk about who's got the power, he certainly has a lot of that. But he doesn't particularly have a lot of property. And there are lots of people I could introduce you to, and you know them, who have quite a bit of power, of property, but are not much in the realm of power. They don't. That's not what they do. It's not available to them. So you get the different organization of society, a different way of looking at society, if you focus on the class structure in terms of who owns, the property theory, versus the class structure in terms of who has power. That's the power theory. And they are very, very old. Very, very old. Long before Marx. Now let's turn to Marx, since we're really interested. Actually, before that, let me refer briefly to yet another concept of class, because we're going to talk about it from time to time. It's not as important as the property and power concepts, and it's not as important as the Marxist concept that he really introduced, that I'm going to come to in a moment, but it's very important. This is called the consciousness theory of class. And this says the class you're in, how you divide people in a society into classes, is not to be understood in terms of the property they do or do not own, and is not to be understood in terms of the power they do or do not wield. It's got a completely different definition. People are in classes according, in this theory, to where they think they are. That your class participation, your class position, and the class structure of a society depends first and foremost on people's consciousness. You are what you think you are. So, for example, there's an old joke that I first heard from an African-American woman preacher. And she was giving a sermon in Connecticut, where I was at the time, and she said, I want to talk about the three great classes in America. By the way, my ears perked up because I was so excited at the thought that here in this Baptist church, I was going to hear some class analysis. And she said, there's the haves, there's the have-nots, but I want to talk to the third group because it's the biggest group in this room and it's the biggest group in America. It's the think-they-haves. Very clever, very clever. What she didn't know, because she didn't have a course like this to help her, was that this is a very old idea, that you're in a class based on how you think this society works and how you therefore understand your own position. And this image is evoked often by people who are very proud and smug about the United States and who claim we don't have class conflict because we don't have classes, and we don't have classes because everybody here is in the middle class. And if you push them, they say, I can prove it to you. And then they go out and they do a survey and they discover that 95% of people asked in the United States what class they're in answer proudly that they're in the middle class. Okay, this very interesting way of thinking, but what's going on here is a use of the term class to say you're in a class you're in depending on how you think about the world and your place in it. So all of these are old, and all of these are very new. If you read the speeches of George Bush about the world, and unfortunately also Mr. Obama about the world, then the world is made sense of as a place where there's a struggle between the class of people who want to hold back, by using their power, the spread of democracy, and the others in the world who are trying to change the distribution of power to make for a democratic. The word democratic is used rather than to create an egalitarian class structure, because that's scary language. We don't want to use the class language. So we use this democracy language. But again, democracy is about a particular distribution of power, one that does not have all the power in a few hands with everybody else without power. Rather, the power should be distributed. We want, in the United States these days, ideologically, we want an equal distribution of power, almost as badly as we don't want an equalization of property. Indeed, the intensity of the commitment to an egalitarian distribution of power is the inverse other side of such an anxiety and fear about an egalitarian distribution of wealth. But the main point not to lose sight of: people have been talking about classes, rich versus poor, the property theory, powerful versus powerless, the power theory, and finally the consciousness theory. Class is a matter of how you understand your world and your position in it, for a very long time, just as these are all very widespread today. We're not going to use these class concepts in the rest of this class. We're going to use the different concept that Marx invented and gave to us as his contribution. And if you think other concepts of class have been repressed with the word, that's nothing compared to how this Marxian one has been repressed, because that's even more the case, which is why we're doing this course, to undo that repression, to allow us to think and talk about it rather than to keep it buried in the closets of the past. But before I turn to Marxists, let me just emphasize one more time that to talk about a different concept of class is not to say that the difference between rich and poor is unimportant, or the difference between those who have power and those who don't, it doesn't matter. Not at all. It's been important for people all through history that property is unequally distributed, and what that means, just as it has been important how power is distributed and what that means. And it has been important what people's consciousness is. Those are important parts of social life and of how societies work. Anyone interested in society who didn't care about that thing would be missing part of the story. So nothing that I say, and nothing to be read in Marx, is to denigrate, deny, or demote the importance of property, power, and consciousness. Indeed, the Marxist agenda is about adding something to the lexicon of class, to the way of thinking, not cashiering others, not denouncing others, not ignoring other things, but rather to remedy something repressed, something overlooked, something missed. That was Marx's idea, and that's what we're going to focus on for the rest of this session of courses today and the next four. So what did Marx do? First of all, he talked a lot about property and power and consciousness. He made all kinds of contributions to those questions, some of which are very famous. I'll give you an example. He was very interested not just in property in general — that struck him as silly — he was particularly interested in property in what he called means of production. Who owns the factories, the land, the way we have the raw materials and the tools to produce? Who controls those by ownership? Struck Marx as particularly important, and he talked about that. And likewise, he thought power was an important matter. Who was in a position to give orders? What was the position of military, police, concentrated order givers in a society? He had a lot to say about that. And he was certainly interested in consciousness. Some of the most famous passages that people know about in Marxism is, for example, his discourse on something called the fetishism of commodities. Fetish is a way of thinking. It's about consciousness. It's how people relate to this thing called the market and commodities. And so Marx very interested in that. So Marx wrote about, was interested in, property, power, and consciousness. But his contribution was to add a new and different concept of class, to teach us — that's what he thought he was doing — that there is something else going on in society that he wanted to call class. It was a way of classifying people into their positions in society that differentiated them one from another, but not according to the property they owned, not according to the power they wielded, and not according to their consciousness, but according to something else. So the question is, what else? What was it that Marx was so determined to convey? What had he figured out about the world that he could contribute? Because after all, he was a writer. He was an intellectual. Again, just to remind you, right, he's a child of middle-classy folks. He did something extraordinary at his time in the middle of the 19th century. He went to the university. 1% of people did that, if that. You know, the majority of Germans at that time were probably illiterate. And they certainly didn't go to school, and they certainly didn't go to university. So he goes to the university, and he studies, heaven help us, philosophy. He writes a dissertation about ancient Greek philosophy and becomes a young philosophy professor. We're not talking about 1% of the German population. We're talking about 0.00001% of the population that he's part of. So he then spends the rest of his life writing things. He goes, does some other things. He organizes meetings, but he's a writer and a thinker. And he can't even stay in his home country of Germany. He's exiled, spends most of his productive life in a different country, speaking a different language, namely in England. So this is a man who has spent his life trying to figure something out, and as well as being an activist, but secondarily to his life as a thinking person. So here's what he can offer. He thought something through. He saw something. He went to work to check whether it was right. He did an awful lot of work, and he concluded he had something to offer. To whom? He always felt himself a radical. He always felt himself a person who wants to make society better. And he had a very clear idea what better meant. And there's no reason to shy away from that. Marx was a committed, ethical, moral human being who was proud of his moral and ethical commitments. That is important to keep in mind, since some later generations of Marxists seemed to need to believe that Marxism wasn't about moral and ethical commitments, but was about a scientific understanding. Yeah, well, read Marx. His passion and his ethics are on every page. He knew who he loved and he knew who he hated. And to summarize that, because you'll see it's important, what Marx loved and what his ethical shining light was the French Revolution. Marx was born in 1818. That's roughly 40 years after the French Revolution. So it's not very long. The French Revolution is the explosion that destroys feudalism. It cuts off the head of Louis the 16th? 16th, okay. And Marie Antoinette, you all know the story, the guillotine, very dramatic. And in the name of the great three-word slogan of the French, Liberté, égalité, fraternité. Liberty, equality, and brotherhood. In the name of those three, we are transforming society, ending centuries of monarchy, ending centuries of inequality of property and power and so forth. And we're going to build a new world, completely different, on the foundation of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Unbelievably dramatic. Revolutionary idea. It happened in France, but Marx was born in Trier, which is a German city close to France. What happened in France is hot news in the town he was born in. And all young intellectuals, with very few exceptions, in Germany, at the time he comes of age of his 20s and 30s, is overwhelmed by the French Revolution and what it means as it sweeps across Europe, first with Napoleon's armies, but afterwards through all the other mechanisms of cultural dispersion, and they're all caught up in this. And Marx is one of a generation of Germans, many, 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 and indeed generation of people all over Europe, in Italy and Spain and everywhere else, who are caught up in the drama and the romance of this world-shaking transformation into equality, fraternity, and brotherhood. But Marx is an honest guy and faces a mystery early in his life, around the 1830s and 40s. The promised new world of the great French Revolution, in which he believed and hoped, wasn't arriving. Germany, as he becomes old enough and mature enough to look around, particularly in the more developed part of Germany, Western Germany, where he comes from, the places around Frankfurt and Mainz and those cities in Germany, the western end of Germany, close to the French border, he looks around. Does he see liberty, equality, and fraternity? On the contrary, he sees inequality, no freedom, and everything but fraternity. He sees the end of feudalism, but the arrival of the industrial working class living in horrible conditions. The conditions in Germany in that period of time were worse than the conditions in England at that period of time, and those were the conditions that appear in Charles Dickens's novels. So he is, as part of his generation, terribly upset. The great revolution to sweep and transform Europe wasn't working. Feudalism had indeed been overthrown. It was gone. There were no more serfs. The kings were gone. Wow. But where was the liberty, equality, and fraternity? And so he set himself, again like others in his generation, the simple question. What happened? What went wrong? What is it we didn't do that prevented us from realizing the point and purpose of all these revolutions? By the way, included the American Revolution, about the same time as the French. What went wrong? And that's really what he went to study, and was driven by his passion and his morals and his ideals. And Marx, unlike so many others, came up with a unique, distinctive explanation. And in the course of it, figured out something that he then bequeaths to the rest of us by writing it up at great length. He's a very prolific writer. Above all, in the three volumes of Capital, his mature major work of his life, but in many other writings and speeches he gave as well. So what he did, I'm going to argue with you, is to figure out, to invent, and to present to us a new and different concept of class. Was he the first person to talk about class analysis? I've already shown you, not at all. What he contributed was a different way of understanding class, in which what your class position is, how you relate to class, what class means in your life, is something different from property, power, and consciousness. Wow. And to give you the punchline of why it pays to pay attention to what Marx wrote, here's his argument. The reason our earlier efforts, we who are progressive, we who are modern, we who love the ideals of the French and American and other revolutions, the reason it failed was we did make changes in property, we did make changes in power, and we did make changes in consciousness. But we didn't make some other changes, and therein lies the flaw. We didn't understand that something else had to be changed. And because we didn't pay attention to it, we didn't change it very much. And because we didn't change it very much, we couldn't even hold on to those gains in the distribution of power, property, and consciousness that the revolutions achieved. So the revolutions, instead of being the step to liberty, equality, and fraternity, faded out. And we ended up with a society, mid-19th century Europe, which has no liberty, no equality, and no fraternity. So it's important, says Marx, to see this thing so we don't make that mistake again. So that the next upsurges of human beings in the interest of liberty, equality, and fraternity will be more successful than we have been. That's what he leaves to the next generation. And my argument, as you'll see, is that we remain the people to whom this message is given. It'll be up to us whether this time we can get it, as earlier generations of Marxists didn't. But let me then turn to what is it that Marx did? And I'm not going to go through, because we don't have the time, all the steps Marx used to get there. I'm going to give you the end result, because we're going to have to work with it for the rest of this class, and so I only have the time to present it to you here. But if any of you are interested, believe me, there are ways in which there's literature out there, and you can pursue it, and I'd be glad to provide that to anyone who wishes. Here's Marx's conclusion. Human beings are engaged in a process that they have not very well understood. And some had glimpses. I see in the works of predecessors of mine, in ancient writings, but in modern writings too, Marx says, glimpses of this, but they never kind of put it all together, and I want to do that. And by the way, if you're interested, Marx has another three-volume work that very few people know about. It isn't called Capital, but it is three volumes, and it's about as long as Capital altogether. And these three volumes are called Theories of Surplus Value. And what they are Marx's notes, because he was a very close and careful researcher. And he wrote out notes. There are three volumes of his notes on all of the major thinkers before him that, in his view, glimpsed something of what I'm about to tell you. And he there shows you his personal debt and the debt of his insight to all the people that come before. Unusual for a thinker to write. Very few major thinkers in the modern world who have been as careful and as open as Marx in showing his intellectual debts. By the way, you will see in these volumes, if you're interested, long detailed analyses by Marx of people that you know, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and a whole host of other thinkers. And it's really interesting because, again, you don't see that often, a person who lays out how much he has learned. And by the way, no dismissal there. He's very respectful to these people. He does make criticisms, but it's in the context of an immense appreciation. So what is it that people, except for these forebears that he honors, what is it they missed? And I would argue that this is not only missed in the people who come before Marx, it's still missed, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing, because if it wasn't missed, you wouldn't need this course. But what is it that's missed? Here's his answer. Throughout human history and in all human communities, something happens that we don't take cognizance of enough, that we don't pay attention to and we don't integrate into our way of thinking. In every human community, something happens that I think is crucial for us to focus on, and let me tell you what it is, he says. In every community, some portion of the people, typically adults, spend their time using their brains and their muscle to transform nature into a whole bunch of products. They make things. To use modern language, they do work. So, for example, they use their brains and their muscles to transform a tree into a chair, to transform some plants that they grow into a loaf of bread, to take care of animals and process them into a woolen shirt, and so on. They do work. But in every human community, of which there's any record, past and present, it's always true that a part of the society doesn't do work, doesn't do that, doesn't spend their time using brains and muscles to transform nature into products. And so in every community, there has to be a way developed to make the following decisions. One, who's in the two groups? Who is going to be doing the work and who isn't? Number two, the people who don't do the work are going to die because of no food, no shelter, no clothing, unless the people who, here comes the punchline now, unless the people who do the work produce more stuff than they themselves consume. There has to be an extra produced by those who work if you're going to sustain the people in the community who don't. Marx's language there. The work that those who do work do, the fruits of which they themselves consume, is only ever a part of what they produce. The people who work can never stop working once they have produced what they themselves consume. They don't stop working when they've made enough food, clothing, shelter, etc., to clothe and feed themselves, because they, here we go, socially, have to produce more than they themselves consume to enable those who don't work to also consume. The part of the work that the workers do that take care of them, that takes care of themselves, Marx referred to as necessary labor. It's the labor necessary for the laborer to keep going, to keep working. But the part of the work that the workers do that's in excess of that, that's more than what's necessary to take care of themselves, that is in English called surplus labor. It's the part of the labor of the working portion of the community that is in excess to what they themselves consume. By the way, in Marx's writing, in German, he uses the very simple language. There's the labor that the workers do that takes, that sustains themselves, and then there is more work. He uses the German word mehr, M-E-H-R, which is the German equivalent of the English more. He says there's more work that they do, but they don't get the fruits of that work. Whoa, here we go, pay attention. People produce more than they themselves get. And that more is, mystery of mysteries, transferred, transmitted, distributed to the people who don't work. And, says Marx, how each society organizes this process is a way of differentiating one society from another, because human communities have and continue to do this in different ways. And how a community does it, how it decides who does the work, how it decides how the people who do the work, how big a surplus are they going to produce, and who is going to get it, and how is it going to be distributed to those every society has to decide that. Every society does decide it. But, says Marx, they do it differently. And how they do it, here comes the punchline, shapes the society. Shapes its politics, shapes its culture, shapes its history, shapes its tensions, shapes its love affair, shapes everything. And if you don't understand that, you're not going to see an important shaper of the world you live in and the life you're leading. And you're sure as hell, here we go now, not going to be able to make the kinds of social changes you're after. Because here's what you might do. You might change the property in a society. You might change the power. And you might change the consciousness. And all of that's important. But if you don't think about, know about, the organization of the surplus, and you don't change that, the unchanged nature of the organization of the surplus may come back and bite you in the rear end. How? By undoing those changes in property, power, and consciousness that you did achieve. Which, as you will see, I'm going to be arguing, is precisely what happened over and over again. In the French Revolution, in the Russian Revolution, in the Chinese Revolution, and therefore the most important lesson perhaps modern rebels and radicals can learn, so they don't reproduce the mistake again. So Marx's argument is that he wants to introduce into the radical community that thinks in terms of class analysis, so he accepts that environment, that language, that tradition, but he says there's another kind of class structure that going on that you haven't understood, that we need to come to terms with, and I'm going to now tell you what I figured out about it. Okay? That's his project. That's why, just in a footnote, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the literature, but if you actually sit down and you read the three volumes of Capital, Marx's mature, sort of majestic work of his adulthood, you'll see that it's about the surplus. Volume 1 of Capital is about how surplus is produced in a capitalist society, like the one we live in. And volumes 2 and 3 are about how the surplus gets distributed to all the people who don't participate in its production. That's what it's about. It's not about property primarily, it's not about power primarily, and it's not about consciousness. It talks about those things because they were important to Marx. But the central organizing topic of Marx's work is the production and distribution of surplus in a society, and in particular in a modern capitalist society. Okay, let's begin now to develop this Marxist idea, what the specificity and uniqueness of a Marxian class analysis amounts to. As I said to you, Marx's insight was that the surplus is organized, the production of it, the distribution of it, differently in different societies. And he went to work to catalog that, to show that. And to make his argument, he made, as all theorists do, certain simplifying assumptions so his story could be told. It's bad enough you write something in three volumes, right? How many people have the patience to read one, let alone three? So it was hard even to crunch it as much as he did. But he did. And he developed five basically different ways, five, that human societies have organized the surplus. And I'm now quickly going to go through them because we're going to need them when we analyze, using Marxian class analysis, every society that we're going to think about in this course. Why? Because most societies, certainly the United States today, but most societies have all of these five going on in them at the same time. Okay? So please, as we go through these five, do not think of a society as either one or the other. Most societies are mixtures of these different class societies. And when I'm done, I'm going to use the United States as an example to show you concretely how here in the United States we have all five of them. Now let me go through them. First, the one to which Marx gave an interesting name, a name that has worried people ever since. The name he gave was communism. So he gives the name communism to a way of organizing the surplus. So what is that way? Very simple to explain. It really is. Marx does all this work for us. That's why it's simple. It's not a simple idea. It's now simple to express because a lot of work has been done. Here's the idea. In a communist economic arrangement, in a communist class structure, what we have is the part of the population, the subgroup, that does the work, that uses the brains and muscle to transform nature. They themselves, here we go now, they're the ones who get the surplus. That is, they produce that extra, the beyond what they themselves consume, but here comes the key point. They not only produce the surplus, but they themselves take hold of the surplus. It's theirs. And they distribute it to the rest of the community. Wow. Why did Marx use the term communist? Because it's the community of the workers who does the distribution. The community of workers gets their own extra, their surplus, the more output they produce beyond what they themselves consume. It's the community of workers who, now using Marx's language, appropriates, takes the surplus they themselves have produced and distribute them. That's what makes it communal, community, communist. Please notice, nothing in Marx's definition makes any reference whatsoever to the state or the government. It's irrelevant to his definition of communism. So when you hear the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the evening TV news talk about communism or a powerful state as if nothing were more normal, natural, and universally agreed as that, you are now in a position to sneer, because this is ignorance, and not an innocent ignorance either. The notion that communism has a powerful state has to do with the Soviet Union and China, with whatever you think about them, that's what that's about. It's the identification of this concept of communism with those particular countries, but it has nothing to do with Marx. Nothing. Marx never wrote a book about the state. Wasn't important enough to him. He had plans, if you notice his plans at the end, he had plans to write about the state. It's an interesting topic, but it was not his primary interest. and his definition of communism had nothing to do with it. Communism is one way to organize the surplus. Here's the second way. And Marx gave to that a funny name. It isn't useful, but I'm going to use it because it's in the literature. He called it the ancient class structure. Not the communist, the ancient. Funny word because it implies long ago. But this ancient is as present today as it ever was long ago. Here's what it is. In this arrangement, the work is done not by a group of people, the way I've been talking about it up to now, but by each individual alone. The adult man or woman who's out there using his, her brains and muscles to transform nature to produce goods. Think of an individual farmer or peasant. Think of an individual craftsman or woman. Think of an individual person making software with their laptop in the garage. The point here is an individual, and Marx's argument is, that individual cannot and never does stop working when he or she has produced enough goods and services to sustain themselves. As with the community, the communist class structure, the individual who works on his or her own always produces more than they themselves consume. They also always produce a surplus, which they also distribute to other people. And so Marx is fascinated. This is a different way. What these two ways, communist and ancient, have in common is something very profound. The people who make the surplus get it and distribute it. That, he thinks, is remarkable. But they're very different because in the first one, it's a collective of people that are doing that. In the second one, it's an individual. What are some of the modern terms for Marx's idea of the ancient class structure? The self-employed person. The self-employed. Interesting word. Same idea. So it's very modern. Think of an individual doctor, individual dentist, individual architect, individual software engineer, individual you fill in the blank. So that's two, the communist and the ancient. The next three, out of the five, there's only three left, the next three are different ways of organizing the surplus. And their key difference for Marx is that in each of the next three, you're going to notice something different from the first two. And here's the difference. In the next three, the people who produce the surplus don't get it. They do not participate in distributing it. Right? In the first two, the communist and the ancient, the person or persons who produce the surplus get it and distribute it. In the next three, the people who produce the surplus don't get it and they don't distribute it. And Marx has a very important term to describe those organizations of the surplus in which the people who produce it don't get it. Those systems he called exploitative. The word exploitation in Marx has a precise definition. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're nice to the people who work there, whether you beat them or underpay them or anything else. It has nothing to do with that. Exploitation exists if and only if the people who produce a surplus are not the people who get it and distribute it. Other people are. So let's go through the three exploitative class structures that Marx identified. First, slavery. In a slave system, we have what? We have one group of people who work, use their brains and muscles, they transform nature. I'll give you an example. African-American slaves working in cotton plantations in the American South before the Civil War. Every day they got up. They used their brains and their muscles to plant cotton, harvest cotton, all the rest. At the end of the day, or week or year, doesn't matter, all, this is very important, all of the fruits of their labor go to somebody else, the master. They get nothing. They're slaves. They're entitled to nothing.